Accession number 29076, reel 3.
To me, and then it'll be better for you, you see. So two or three of them had these revolvers, and they handed them over to him, you see. Obviously a gentleman, you see. This is very early on in the war. So he put this, I think he was still wearing a flying suit, because, yes, in fact, that's part of the story, because when these chaps came a bit nearer, they reckon they've got the whole crew there, you see, and they surrendered the lot, including Farquhar, especially as he was carrying German revolvers, which he had to hand over to the land army. And the whole lot were, first of all, marched up the hill to... Duga was now Farquhar is now a prisoner of war, and the land army marched him and the rest of them up to a local farmhouse, and the farmer's wife brewed a cup of tea, and whilst they waited the arrival of somebody in uniform, land army, company of the army of some sort or the other, who came up with their rifles and the real business, and the whole thing was explained, because they sent somebody down to find that it was a Spitfire truly, and that they could verify that the Farquhar was a Brit. He was only in flying kit, because in those days, I mean, you didn't put on anything that could identify you, and I don't know whether his trousers might have been of a sort of Air Force blue, but I don't think they would have taken a notice. The upper part would have been a Sidcut suit or something for flying, you know, flying up a little higher and so on. So he got back to base and raised hell, and it was much commended, and also slightly, not commended for ruining one Spitfire like that, but... Still, in fact, it was a good thing, because they got all the Heinkel intact and everything that was in it, including these traps. So, sorry, that was a little side issue.
Nigel Rose, reel 3.
Up at Drem, then we were doing patrols during daytime, but as I said, didn't see any German aircraft then. This was the time of the German push across France and the British Army beginning to collect at Dunkirk. We were getting a certain amount of interest at night, and I can remember going out onto the runway in charge of the chance light, or whatever it's called, the floodlight, when we were doing night flying because of some enemy action. And there you have the awkwardness of hearing a German bomber overhead and wanting to switch on the light to give a bit of guide to your own chaps coming in after being in the air for some time. It was a nasty feeling. You felt if you were floodlighting the runway, it was just a beautiful marker for the bomb aimers, but that was really the only sort of action I saw in those days. Until August the 13th, we left for West Hampton, which is a satellite airfield, a grass airfield, for Tangmere.
Did you do any night flying yourself in Drem?
Then not. No, later on I did, but no, not then.
Could you describe the airfield itself at Drem, and the layout? And
at Drem?
Yeah.
Well, it was a grass airfield. There were no runways. And I think I talked about floodlighting a runway, but it would have been floodlighting a flare path. You see, I'm sorry, that's the business of 60 years and more of memory. But you remind me, there wasn't a runway then. And yes, you have a flare path laid out, of course, and so you could guide the... you had this chance light, which would give some guidance to aircraft landing. And anyway, then...
So just before you get onto that, when you were off duty, as it were, how would you spend your time?
Either running into Edinburgh or North Berwick or one of the towns around. At night times, alternate flights would take six Spitfires out to McMurray, it was called, or Trenent, an airfield about 5 miles away, which was even more crude than our field and more muddy too. I mention that because one evening it was our turn, a flight, to run the aircraft out to fly the aircraft out to McMurray, and I thought I heard a click when I landed and touched down, which seemed a bit strange, but nothing really much more. When I taxied into the hut which where the airmen were, one of them came out and said, come out and have a look at what you've done. I sort of thought, well, what have I done? Don't be silly. And when I climbed out, I found that the underside of the aircraft had been completely ripped out. Apparently I'd landed on a stick marking a muddy patch. It was a muddy flag, I may say, because I never saw it. And it had nicked the parachute flare door open on the underside of the fuselage. It had a little catch on it, and apparently I'd just touched that and it had opened the parachute flare door. The parachute flare, which was a great cylindrical thing with attached to its own parachute and so on, fell out and soared its, as I was going along, say 40, 50 miles an hour still, it soared its way down the fuselage and made a most appalling mess of the aircraft. The aircraft apparently was more or less a complete write-off, I think, and it had to go back for a completely new fuselage, and I must have done about £3,000 worth of damage, and in those days that's a lot of money, that was, in this unfortunate accident. Fortunately my CO was very sympathetic, and I was sort of expecting to be really chewed up to small pieces, but he was extremely nice bloke, and said that any of them could have done it, and you know, they were sorry on my behalf and so on. So I was absolved, more or less.
Who was your CO?
Sandy Johnston, AVR Johnston. He was an extraordinarily nice chap, and the curious thing is that he came and 5 years ago died quite close here. I saw a lot of him in his last years, more than anybody else in the squadron, in fact, who'd survived. But there it was. I'll tell you more about that later, perhaps. So,
sorry, what was the purpose of the parachute flare?
Well, that was so you could light up. I suppose you've got to make a forced landing or something, and in the sort of either moonlight or such light as there was in the sky, you saw what you thought might be a reasonable place to land. You could pull the thing that released this parachute flare, and for just a few minutes you would light up the countryside. It was terrific candle power, enormous amount, and you know, magnesium, something like that. And so if this thing had gone off, I shouldn't be talking to you here today, I'm sure. The aircraft would have gone up, actually, because it almost certainly would have set fire to the thing. But there we are. It didn't go off. So that was one thing I mentioned. You were saying what one would do in the evenings, but I don't remember very much activity. I suppose I probably had drinks and a mess and things like that, and these visits to local towns. And then we got postage. Shall I go on now? On 13th of August, we were sent down to Tangmere, to West Hampton. We called at Airfield in Yorkshire on the way, if I remember right. Anyway, we landed at West Hampton about five in the evening, I think it was. And there was a terrific battle going on at the time, and the aircraft limping in. The squadron we were relieving, 145 squadron, had really been shot to pieces over the last few days. They were in a sorry state. I think there were only five serviceable aircraft and five or a few more serviceable pilots out of probably, I don't know. If we go back 2 or 3 weeks, it was probably 17 of each, I suppose, something like that. But they really had an awfully hard time of it, and they were ready to be posted somewhere up to the north for rest, I think, such as have survived.
This was in August, was it?
This was August the 13th, and you see, the Germans had already been sending over these vast arrays of aircraft for some 2 or 3 weeks by then, or more, I think, or 3 or 4 weeks. And so Churchill and Dowding's advice, or not to run the squadrons down too much or not send his 4 squadrons to France, was probably right, because they needed all they could find back in this country. Anyway, there we, it was a lovely summer's afternoon. I remember having tea out in the garden when we arrived, and wasps all around, and writing a note to my parents, which we had there, where I said we bagged 5 before supper or something, and those were 5 wasps, I think. I don't think we flew that first day again. I think we just landed and let the aircraft be serviced and got ready. I don't think I flew for the next 2 or 3 days. Not sure, it's probably all in my logbook. But the squadron generally got into action straight away. In fact, the next morning they were flying. And we used to do 3 or 4 trips each day, more or less, if it was a flying day and the weather was okay and the Germans were sending these planes over. We would do 3 or 4 sorties, as we call them, or patrols, as a matter of course. You could get quite tired at the end of all that. I suppose partly emotional strain, and but because at that time of the year you could be called up onto readiness at 4 in the morning, you see, and the airmen had already been up and got the engines ticking over and warming up, and you might not have a patrol until breakfast time because the Germans probably wanted to have their breakfast before they set off, expected. But you were up in the air probably round about breakfast time, and on the first one, the first trip. But some of the big ones they sent over, some of the big clouds of aircraft they sent, a huge fleets of bombers accompanied by equally huge fleets of fighters, you know, 50, 70, 90, over 100 at a time sometimes. In that book I was showing, I mean, Sandy Johnson, I think, mentions 100 the first time I ever saw these. I think I put 50 down in my logbook, but maybe I only saw the lot we were sent after, which were the fighters. Another 50 aircraft may have been bombers that B flight were after. That was my first baptism of fire. It was on about the 17th, I think, of August. And we were split into two by Sandy. He kept the bombers, I think, to himself in B flight, and we went off A flight, I think. Is that right? I think so. We're sent to look after the fighters and keep them away as much as we could. So there it was. I remember we were looking down on them, which was a good thing. So the controllers had obviously got us up in time, and we were looking down on this mass of aircraft, and Sandy, or no, the flight commander, I think, because I think Sandy was in charge of the other lot. I think it would have been Mickey Mount, I think his name was, Mickey Mount, I think, said, right, select your aircraft and off you go. And I can remember sort of getting a feeling for one of the chaps right at the back, because it seems to be the stragglers were the blokes to sort of go for. So one turned one's gun button to fire, which meant this little Merle button on the top of the control column turned to fire, and you were already sort of set to go. You had 8 machine guns in the Spitfire 1. This was in its early days, you see. There were no cannon there. We were at a disadvantage with Messerschmitt 109s, which of course had a cannon and firing through the nose and through the propeller boss. And that was a thing in their favour, because it was easier for them, really, to demolish their prey if they managed to get a lucky hit, you know, or a carefully thought out hit too. But anyway, I remember coming down onto this chap, and I must have opened fire at what I thought was getting close enough, but my camera for once was working, and so ultimately I had the film, the developed film, sent back, and with comment that I was out of range when I opened fire, and I wasn't really altogether surprised. And I don't know how close I I got to him, but it's probably not terribly clear as being the first time. And I'd seen all these Messerschmitt 110s, which are rather bigger than 109s and possibly more menacing looking, although they're much slower, really. Anyway, he flicked on his back very suddenly and went down. I got some smoke coming out of one of his engines. At least smoke did come out. Whether I got it, I imagine I did. And as though he'd perhaps pierced, got a lucky one through a radiator or something like that. So there was a cloud of white smoke coming out. And he flicked over on his back and went down, as I thought, sort of vertically, more or less. And I thought, gosh, this is fighting. but like so happened so often, I followed him for a little way, but by the time I'd sort of levelled off and come out of it, as so often happens, and everybody else I'm sure you talk to about these sort of things will agree, there's nobody in the sky. There, one moment there are masses of aircraft, all flying in one direction, admittedly, whereas you've probably flown a bit in the wrong direction after chasing this chap. But there's nobody to be seen, you know. So you wander home feeling rather proud at having had a... I don't know how much ammunition I used, but you have you had, I think, 14 seconds worth firing all 8 guns. And you see, each of them fires about 20 rounds a second, I think. So, what's that, 1,200 rounds a minute, isn't it? So there was quite a lot of firepower there, each of them firing like that. If you could bring your guns to bear. And I think, for me, this was the thing about not going to an operational training unit where they would have said, now, Rose, you can't, if you think that you're sort of close, if you're not, you're miles out of range. You've got to get in close behind, and when you watch your rear, because there's probably somebody behind you, so watch out for it, but get in close behind and then get them in your sights and then squirt when you're within 250 yards, because that's where the guns are synchronised, you see. Well, I didn't get this wisdom imparted to me, or if I did, I'd forgotten it, and it wasn't strong enough. So I don't think I ever really got within murderous range. But at any rate, I did later on get at least these trails of smoke from planes, and I did get them to turn over and go down and so on. So at least I must have frightened some. But at any rate, on this one occasion, the first occasion, one went home feeling so quite happy at having sort of made the chap possibly dive in, but... later on, when I got a little wiser, the thing, I think probably he was going home to tea or lunch or whatever it was. You know, his they were two-seaters, these Messerschmitt 110s, and the chap probably said to his pilot, look, we better get the hell out of here, we've got a Spitfire after us, you see. So I suppose they may not have thought much more about hanging about, and the Spitfires were quite revered as aircraft, even by them, by the Germans. So I think he may have been getting out of it, getting down into the cloud and hiring off home. But I don't know. You don't know whether you might have had a lucky shot at the pilot. But, well, anyway. So there was that type of engagement, and there were quite a few of these where they sent these great things over, and we were, as much as possible, got up into a state where we could come down on them out of the sun with some advantage. Other times, not quite, we're more or less on a level with them, and occasionally on the wrong altitude with them. But all sorts of various things which I describe in my letters. I don't suppose you want me to recount any or all of those, but there were one or two which perhaps I could mention. For instance, one day we'd been out about... I think 10 miles out to sea, perhaps not as much, yes, about 10 miles, I think, out to sea off Selsey Bill. And I think we'd been trying to run into a crowd coming over either to Portsmouth or Bristol. I'm not sure which. I suppose it would be Portsmouth, because I think they would have been further west if it had been Bristol. And we got engaged, and this time again, in Spitfires, we were often sent up particularly to try and handle fighters. And although our chaps did get a crack at the bombers, it was usually B flight, and A flight seemed to be designated towards the fighters most of the time. And I got into a whirl of 110s, and they had a habit, if they saw several Spits going for them, they got themselves into a protective circle, which was rather cunning, and they'd go round in a big circle, you see, where they could get a a bead on in his spit that was firing at the chap in front of him, so to speak. And I hadn't really had much experience of this, and I fastened on to a number of these chaps and fired away at several of them. But I don't know that I did get a certain amount of smoke from whatever it was from these chaps. And then I was going really a bit harder for one of them, and you know, suddenly there was a colossal bang, and the aircraft sort of bucked up. It sort of became non-flyable for a while, and I thought, oh, Christ, this is this is probably it. And I never saw the chap who was firing at me, but it made an awful mess of the aircraft, and I got a bit of a wound in the elbow, but it didn't amount to very much. And I found the aircraft didn't seem to be very well controllable, and we were going into a gentle dive. So I thought, well, it sounds to me as though I've got to get out of this. And I put the hood back and undid the belt and the straps, and got my feet more or less up on the seat. And then I found that it was levelling out, being left on its own devices, and I got down into the seat and found that it would react to control, which was rather good, because if we were 10 miles out at sea, and I didn't fancy getting a wetting in that distance, so I found it would fly, and what's more, it answered to the controls on the engine. But they had shot up the air bottle, and that meant there were no flaps and no brakes, and the radio had gone too. I think there were various sort of holes and things in it. It's mostly been down the fuselage towards the rear that made a bit of a mess of the tailplane altogether. It felt very funny to fly. Anyway, got back to West Hampnett, and with no flaps and no brakes, I had to be a bit careful about coming into land. The undercarriage was all right and worked, which was a good thing. And I made two or three attempts to get a decent sort of speed and angle of approach, because of you know, with no brakes, you were a bit at the mercy of doing a short landing. So at the end, I managed to do a short landing and tottered to a standstill about a metre or two from the far edge, I think. And again, one had this sort of feeling of having done something, but mostly had one of our own aircraft destroyed, which was not a very sensible thing to have done, but slight feeling of having been in action. And well, that put me off flying for about a month. I had to go to Halton and get a sort of board of medical board to sort of say everything was okay. But it really was only it sort of opened up a little flap on the elbow. But there were some little bits of steel still to be seen, but not much. And I was sent on leave. My parents were staying up at Sheffield at the time, and I went up to see them. And they sent me round to the local hospital to have this thing dressed. And when I went to the A&E department, or whatever it was called in those days, the nurse said, oh, what a nasty gravel rash that is. I said, gravel rash hell. I thought, well, that's what you get for getting wounded to action. Anyway, so...
Do you remember what date that was?
That must be in September the 11th, I think it was. Well, the hospital visit must have been about September the 16th or 17th, I think, but the day I was in action that day was September the 11th. So I missed the big day, September the 15th, which was, you know, what they always sort of count as the big day, when they claimed 180-something or whatever it was, but it was later reduced to a much smaller figure than that. But that business of claims, it is often discussed in so many books and so on. And when you've been through this sort of thing, you do understand why it is, because a lot of aircraft will have claimed the same victim. And a lot will have probably done sided and found the chap had gone over in what appeared to be a sort of irretrievable dive out of it, and obviously was going to his doom. But as you went on getting more and more experience, you began to realise what that was all about. Yes, it's possible he might have received fatal damage, either the pilot or some bit of the aircraft, but unless you saw things fly off it, or it burst into flames, or the pilot bailed out or whatever, there was a strong chance that it wasn't a confirmed victim, and so in a way it should not have been claimed. But So I think there's always an excuse for this sort of thing, and it's not surprising in the sort of heat of things. And when you come to think of it, aircraft flying around on an average at about 250 miles an hour in those days, and often flashing past each other at a closing speed of 500, and these sort of high speeds, things happen so fast, your memory and reactions and so on are very much slowed up, and or very, very sort of apt to be forgotten, I think, I suppose, not slowed up so much as crammed into a short space.
Were there set criteria on claiming a...
Well, that I suppose what I said was about it, that you should really come back with some evidence. You see, we were carrying camera guns, but they were failing so often. The old G45, I think it was called, camera gun was, I think, 18 millimetre or 9 millimetre. It was tiny. I don't know, 18 millimetre, I think it was. Does that sound right? Anyway, it was a very small little film with, you know, little holes down each side. And they rode over sprockets in this camera, which was out in the wing. Now, if you were doing a sort of steep turn, when you were putting on the G, and you were probably going sort of semi-conscious at the time as you were going round, or pulling out, or whatever it is, you know, you put on G-forces, the camera at the same time was complaining because it really wasn't built for the film to stick its little slots on the sprockets, and it would ride off at an angle and jam. So an awful lot of those camera things either failed soon after being first used, or but you have seen probably camera gun action, and there are some lovely ones of aircraft, particularly from line astern, you know, where you really see chap being really done, dealt with, and sometimes you even see a chap bailing out, and all sorts of interesting things like that, and bombers in particularly, which was all a much slower action with bombers. They've got some wonderful shots of those, where they really, the camera gun did record, you know, fatalities. But when you came down, of course, you didn't have your camera gun shots anyway. They didn't arrive till a fortnight later. But you gave your report to the intelligence officer. I mean, you just gave him your first impressions, and first impressions often were, these ones were much more exciting, and there could be times when, you know, at the time it seemed as though you'd really done the business. It might not have done. But I've known a lot of chaps who did do the business, and they really were very good at their shooting. And many of them were pre-war short service or regular chaps who'd had a lot of training. And by no means all, but quite a lot of them had a great deal of training and knew a lot about how to get your man and firing.
Could you talk a little bit about tactics?
Well, yes, as a sort of junior bloke in the squadron, the squadrons used to fly in those days, certainly take off and climb up in threes, four sections of the 12. We were divided into four sections of three, red, yellow, blue and green. And I was in A flight, which was red and yellow, and I think I used to fly mostly as red three or something, which is the sort of junior bloke in the red section. And later on, we learnt, I think chiefly from the Germans, that it was much better to fly in twos rather than threes, because two with the second chap guarding the first chap's tail was a much more sensible way of flying on these sort